Yeah, okay. So like I said, my main goal here was to do some sort of, some share in memory of Gedalia Schwartz, who, you know, as I mentioned, was really a leading posek in America, in the, I would say in the modern-Orthodox community, that one of the unique things about him was that he was really respected across the spectrum. Really everywhere in the country, especially in Chicago, which is where he was, where he lived. So I figured that the, you know, his psak that we really should focus on was his the tshuva that he penned after 9/11 to be matir all the agunot whose husbands died without a trace in the Twin Towers. And at the time, he was the Rosh Hashanah of Beis Din, and therefore was the person who presided over the... It took, I think, about the majority of that year to really work through all the issues for all the cases, and really many poskim were brought in to discuss it, not just within YU and the Beis Din of America, but Rav Ovadia Yosef was involved, as well. Nechemia Goldberg was involved. And eventually they put together, this is really an excellent volume if you get your hands on it, Contending with Catastrophe, which is put down by the put out by the Beis Din of America, which combined basically the halachic halachic articles, hashkafic articles, theological reflections, tefillot that were written after after 9/11. And put them into this to this volume. So what I want to do is quickly outline some of the complexities here, and then I gave you, you know, again, because I didn't want to focus on the issue in general, I want to focus specifically on Gedalia Schwartz. I gave you his tshuva, which actually goes through the theory and then the policies used to be matir each one of the women, and he goes through them one by one. But to give you at least a framing of what we're talking about, Rabbi Jachter in this volume summarizes, and most of this is available online, at least a slightly less edited version of it. Rabbi Jachter wrote a summary of the issues. So here's the background. The word aguna, classically, in halachic literature, does not mean what it has come to mean in modern culture as much, right? I mean, people now talk about aguna, what they normally mean is, and they're usually talking about modern aguna, meaning women whose husbands have refused to give them a get, which is a very important topic, but not this topic. The classic aguna, which is what this really is a woman whose husband disappears and they're not sure if he's dead. And therefore, because they're not sure, she's stuck because her husband isn't there. But he might not be dead, so she can't remarry. Right? That's a classic case of aguna. And the reason that it's so difficult in this direction is because men marrying two wives is a violation of cherem derem and of gershom, and therefore, were the opposite to happen, it would be problematic. But there are easier solutions, whereas a woman can't marry two husbands. So if her husband is alive, then she can't remarry. Yeah. What expired? So whatever the cherem derem gershom is, without getting into it, whatever it is, it's clearly not daraisa. It's a cherem, which, sure, maybe it technically expired, but whatever it is, right, it's we treat it as if it's still in place, but it's still only a violation of that, and therefore, if the opposite happens, it's much easier halachically to deal with the problem, because you're just contending with cherem derem gershom, or the continuation of cherem derem gershom, or whatever. So the classic sugya for this is the Gemara in Yevamot, which deals with the case of Mayim She'en Lahem Sof, where the Gemara talks about water, right? If a husband drowns in a pond, so then if he doesn't come up after a certain amount of time, you're allowed to let the woman remarry, because since you can see the borders of the water, you assume that if he doesn't, right, he went under water and you didn't see him come up for, you know, amount, the amount maximum that anyone can live, so you assume he's dead. Mayim, the classic case in halacha is what's called Mayim She'en Lahem Sof, right? Where he seems to drown in the ocean, right? Or something like that. Meaning water that you don't see the end of it. Because then you don't know, he could have floated away. Right? So that becomes the shorthand for all cases of a husband who is lost, but we don't know if he's dead. Okay? Mayim She'en Lahem Sof. In that case, the Gemara says the woman can't remarry. And that's the sugya that everyone wants to understand. Okay? But here's the problem. On the one hand, you don't want to be too machmir because you're playing with the rest of the woman's life. But you don't want it to be too makil because you're dealing with ishadish. Right? You're dealing with marriage and adultery and mamzerud and all the things that come with it. So it's a very hard place to be. And that's why here, right, Jachter quotes the Samchaye, who says, it's comparable to one who's running away from a lion and has encountered a bear. Right? As the battle has caught him from the front and behind, just as he fears being lenient, so too does he fear being strict. But in general, the way the Gemara puts it is that Chazal put several levels of chumra on in order to enable you to be mekel when necessary. And in each generation, what you see is that poskim bend over backwards to try to be mekel as much as they can. And this is really celebrated throughout history. And in each generation that has a cataclysmic event where husbands are lost, poskim address it anew, deal with changes in the reality as they face it, reapply the halacha, and come up with a new body of literature that helps the next generation. So you have Ramosha Feinstein, who has celebrated Chuvot after World War II, and the Holocaust, Rabbi Yitzchak Levi Herzog, who was the first chief rabbi of Israel, Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Israel, dealt with the Agunot after the Melchemet Asmod in 48. Rav Avadya Yosef was the primary posek dealing with the Yom Kippur War, etc. And in general, poskim, because of the gravity of the situation, are very hesitant to poskim by themselves. And the Aruch HaShulchan writes that, especially in complicated cases, rabbis try to get at least two other great rabbis to agree to their psak. And you'll see this, that Rav Gedalia Yosef Schwartz is going to put his psak in, but they're signed on by Rav Avadya Yosef, Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, right, who was sent to leading poskim in the world to get them to agree. Okay, so now, what types of evidence, though, do we take into account? So here's the problem. We would really like testimony. But testimony could get complicated because it could be that the only testimony, either you have no testimony at all, right? Or the testimony you have is from people who are pasul eidut, right? Like a lot of the people, they're, you know, maybe their co-worker saw them, their co-worker is not Jewish, right? So they can't really be eidim, so that you have to figure out how to deal with that. And also, what happens if people might be inclined to lie, right? Because they, let's say, don't believe that the husband's alive, and therefore they want the woman to be able to remarry on her own terms, but they don't believe in halacha, right? Let's say the non-Jewish coworker, right? Forget the formal problem. There's also the problem that maybe they want to see their coworker's wife have a happy life, but they don't believe in halacha. They're Christian, whatever, right? They're atheist, they're whatever, right? So that complicates the way we deal with it. Another thing that you'll see in this is that poskim sometimes, especially when it comes to aguna issues, where you're dealing with ishadish, sometimes in halacha, poskim are comfortable making a single argument. That's not the case usually in aguna issues. They try to pile on as many arguments as they can in favor of kula, because you're dealing with very severe situations. In the case of 9/11, a lot of the problems was they really had no evidence of whether the people were died at all. They just know they were up on those floors, but they have no tangible evidence. They just assume. So the questions that came up to them were divided into certain categories. One was, That in halacha, one of the ways you can figure out whether someone's dead is what's called simanim. Right? If you find the body within 3 days of death, so then you can say, oh, this is the husband's body, he's dead. What counts as a siman? So according to Shulchan Aruch, if you find the body within 3 days, and you have the face, so that counts. But if you find a body after 3 days, and you don't find the body with the face intact, then you can't use the body, because you can't tell that it's the person. Short of that, some of the poskim talk about things that are not the face, but what's called a siman muvhak. And simanim are divided into different categories. There's siman muvhak, which poskim say, some poskim say something like something that only 1 in 1,000 people have, and therefore if we see it, we can be pretty sure that it's the husband. But then there's like middle level simanim, simanim beinoniim, that are neither, right? A common siman obviously doesn't help, right? He's white. Great. There were a lot of people who were white, right? So, okay, I mean, great, right? He had brown hair. I mean, okay, right? Then there are like mid-level ones where that doesn't work by itself, but some poskim, like there are chashochim, think that if you have a lot of in-between level simanim, maybe we could cobble that together to prove that the body was the body of the husband. But one of the major problems that you'll see that Rav Gedalia Schwartz dealt with is, okay, that's the classic discussion. In the modern context, what about DNA? And what about dental records? Right? What about that? Because that we did find for some people. What do you do with that? Is that a siman muvhak? Or is it something that halacha never talked about? And therefore you don't know what to do about it. And you'll see that one of the questions that's going to be dealt with is the question of how do you deal with DNA, dental records, and the like, if you have that from the body. So that's one area of discussion that you're going to see in Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz's tshuva. Another issue is, what if you don't find the body, but if you find items that belong to the husband? So, in general, we're not makil on this, because we say that even a very rare item, maybe they lent it to somebody else, and Shulchan Aruch has no exceptions. However, the Chelkat Mechoke, because one of the commentaries on Shulchan Aruch, says that maybe if you find a unique object that people don't usually lend out, that could be at least part of an argument to be makil. So like a wedding ring or something like that, right? Which you wouldn't, is A, unique, right? If you had a unique one, obviously not just a regular gold band, but if you had a unique one, and one that someone didn't lend out, because people don't lend out their wedding rings, so maybe that could be at least a sniff lahakel. And as you'll see in Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz's, this is one of the discussions as well, which is, do we rely on this kula? However, in many of the cases, you didn't even have that. And this was much more comparable to what we call the Mayim Shein Lam Sof. You didn't have a body at all, right? You didn't have a body at all. So as we said, when you have that situation, that's the classic case where someone is Mayim Shein Lam Sof. However, the Gemara, the Mishnah has a case in Yevamot Kuf Chav Bet of someone who says to witnesses, I've been bitten by a snake where there's no cure to the venom, I'm dying. Right? And he said this to witnesses. And now the witnesses come back to Beis Din and they say, we saw such and such a person. He told us his name. He told us what he, that he was poisoned. Based on this, the Mishnah allows the woman to remarry. In the World Trade Center case, they had cases of a husband who stayed on the phone, realized what was happening, and stayed on the phone until he died, and said, right, I am on the 90-whatever floor, we are engulfed in flames, and stayed on the phone till he died, right? Does that count? Is this parallel to that case? Another factor that you find in the Gemara is what's called Yesher Ein Shalom Beinehem. Is that if you find you have a husband who you know that they were having marital problems, then we tend to be much more machmir, because we assume that even if it's unlikely that he escaped, right? If someone's having marital problems and he realizes the whole world thinks he's dead, that might give him an excuse to run away. So how do you weigh that into the equation? how much you have to factor in what you know about their marital harmony. What if you don't know? Right? What if you don't know? Can you rely on Rove that they were probably peaceful, at peace, and the like? Another factor. What about Rove's? Right? What if you know they were on the 93rd floor, and on balance they probably died? You know that for sure, but most people died if they were above the point of impact. Can you rely on a Rove like that? Right? A very likely scenario. That was another factor that was brought in. Now, so that was one of the factors that was brought in, and right, Jasher goes through historically how these things were brought up. Okay, give me, let's say, 5 more minutes to summarize this. Then Ray Jasher summarizes that basically, even when you have, you know, the husband has totally disappeared, there are 6 avenues for leniency that Poskim over the years have basically combined in some variation or the other to come to Kulo. One is Tosfot writes that the reason that we're machmir mayim shein lam sof is because we think that the husband may have survived. But it is possible that we'll have a situation which is more extreme than someone seeming to drown in an ocean, where the chance of survival is even less than surviving the ocean, and therefore we'll count that as not mayim shein lam sof, but a case where the woman can remarry. Right, so that's the first possible argument that Poskim say is an exception to Mayim Shein Lam Sof. 2, Rav Moshe argues that maybe Mayim Shein Lam Sof is only in cases where individuals were involved, but where there are large groups that suffer the same calamity, and we can have sort of a picture of what's going on there. So maybe there, the fact that we know, right, we have like much more than one data point, we can factor that in and say that the arguments of Mayim Shein Lam Sof are not exactly the same, which is one of the Svarot Rav Moshe argued in the Holocaust, that maybe, right, even though there were people who survived, right, because we sort of have a broader data set and we know that the number of people who survived certain situations in the Holocaust was very minimal, right, maybe when you're dealing en masse, that's not the same calculus as Mayim Shein Lam Sof. Third is that some poskim argued that Mayim Shein Lam Sof, you can be mekel if there's trei rubei, 2 factors that push in the direction that the husband has died. So, for example, Rav Chaim of Volozhin was asked about a man who fell from a tall bridge onto ice and then fell into the water. So there, Rav Chaim of Volozhin said it was fine because it's not just that he fell into the water, right? It's most people who fall into the ocean die. And most people who fall from the top of a bridge die. So you saw the person fall off the bridge and then fall into the water, so either one of those by themselves wouldn't have been enough, but seeing the guy fall into the ice and then fall into the water combined is enough to override Mayim Shein Lam Sof. Right? So that's another leniency. Not everyone agrees. The Pesachei Tshuva notes that a lot of people don't agree to this, but some poskim accept this argument. And as you'll see, several of the postgame did in fact invoke it in the 9/11 cases. The fourth kula. This is one of the one that I've actually written about the most extensively. I wrote an article about this a while ago. It basically goes like the following. In the time of the Gemara, there wasn't good communication. And therefore, part of the reason that you couldn't be mekil was that it could be that the person floated to the other side of the ocean and lived on some, you know, far-off island, living fully in society, just can't get back. But throughout the generations, Poskim have suggested variations on the following theme, which is, maybe in a world of mass communication, you can add to the fact that most people who fall into the ocean and, right, seem to have drowned, actually drowned, the fact that most people who would make it to the other side would be able to contact, and would contact their wife. And the fact that they didn't pushes in the direction they're actually dead. And this is an interesting one, because you actually see that in each generation, the Gemara already suggests something like this, but rejects it. Rav Ashi says that if a Talmud Chacham falls into the ocean, you can let his wife remarry, because Talmidei Chachamim were like the celebrities, so if he showed up in some far-off land, the news would get back to you. The Gemara rejects this. But many poskim felt that the Gemara didn't reject it on principle. They only rejected it practically. They said, maybe not. But, starting with the Truman Adeshin, he said, but that was only true in the time of the Gemara, but now travel and communication is better. So maybe nowadays we would accept that argument. And then later poskim, once the trains became popular, or the Chassam Sofer, once the postal services were set up, said, well, maybe 500 years ago we didn't accept this argument, but nowadays we do. And then Reb Moshe said, well, yeah, maybe in the time of Chassam Sofer you didn't accept it, but phones are better. And Reb Avad Yosef in the World Trade Center said, well, once you have cell phones, right, the argument gets even stronger. Right? Most poskim won't rely on this alone, right? But it's a fourth sniff lahakel that they brought into discussion. The fifth is from Reb Elazar of Verdun, who says that maybe the Isra of Mayim Shem Lomasov is not forever. He thinks maybe it's only for a certain amount of time. Right? That basically, when a husband falls into the ocean, we don't let his wife remarry immediately, but we will after, let's say, his example is 4 years. Right? So maybe Mayim Shem Lomasov itself is only a reason to delay issuing a heter to just wait it out, but maybe it doesn't really mean that it's also forever. Again, not everybody agrees to this, but some poskim did. The sixth, and as you'll see, some of the poskim suggested waiting a year to let the wives remarry, to sort of play on this out there. And the sixth avenue of leniency from the Shavuos Yaakov is that maybe the Isser of marrying, of remarrying, is only lechatchila. But b'di'evet, if the woman remarried, we would let her remain married. So that's another possible heter that they were mitzdarif. The last problem that you'll see is that in one of the cases, they didn't just need to prove that the husband died because he was in the Twin Towers. They didn't have direct evidence he was there at all. So they also needed to use circumstantial evidence to place him in the Twin Towers at the time of impact. And here there were, in fact, poskim. There is a history of poskim of relying on basically people's normal habits and patterns to determine where a person probably was at key moments. Okay? So that's the 20-ish minute background to the things that you're going to see. What I want you to do, I just printed out Rav Yaakov Schwartz's Tshuva in English. See how basically these factors worked into it, and then we'll talk about Rav Yaakov Schwartz's Kula and see what it means to be a Rosh Av Beis Din dealing with a really tragic, really cataclysmic event. How do you respond to that halachically? And I think his tshuva is a really good example of the type of broad-shouldered, sensitive posek he was at probably one of the hardest moments in his tenure as the Rosh Av Beis Din. Okay, so what you have is his actual tshuva translated from how he issued the heterim. Okay, so that's over there. Take whatever you need. It shouldn't take us too long to, you know, read it, you know, talk about it afterwards, but read through what you can, and then we'll take 10 to 15 minutes to summarize how he brought these arguments together to solve the halachic problems that came up. So like I said, my main reason for wanting to go through this today was, you know, as I mentioned, right, Rav Gedalia Schwartz passed away a few weeks ago, and as Rai Jachter wrote in his eulogy, not as many people knew him. Rabbis knew him, right? And maybe in Chicago they knew him, but not as many, average Jews on the street knew him, because being the head of a Beis Din is a different role, right? Most of your exposure is to the educated, or really to the rabbinic, right, community. You're dealing with those cases. People are coming to you, so people might not know you as directly. So sometimes seeing his influence is a little bit harder, but he really was the driving force behind the Beis Din for decades. And he was known for being a brave posek and being a posek who was confident enough to deal with the complicated shailas. And as I said, one of where his greatness shone through was it arguably most was in this most complicated case when the Beis Din was faced with the I believe it was 17 women in the end, though right the tshuva only deals with the most complicated cases by the end. And what I think you see as you go through it is really pretty classic of what you find in Shuvot of this sort, which is an attempt to muster as much knowledge as you can to pile on as many arguments in favor of Kula as possible, and to be as makel as possible, but not more than that. but really to be as makel as possible. And you need a posek who's both confident and sensitive and willing to put himself out on a limb in order to do that. And that's really what you see. So this is his tshuva translated. As you see at the footnote here, it was originally published in Hebrew in Hadarom and then translated into English. So as he writes... I'll make just one more point. Many poskim have noted that when it comes to shailas like this, part of what motivates a posek to be makel is his sort of gut conclusion, his gut intuition that the husband really is probably dead. Meaning, if he had an intuition the husband wasn't dead, then you're not going to look for kulot because you have a substantive reason. The reason that poskim, besides for the impact on the woman's life, poskim tend to be willing to be more makil when they think that what's really holding this woman back from remarrying is the technicalities around the sugya, but they intuitively think that the husband is probably dead. And that's really, in many ways what going on here, where you had these husbands who were probably in the upper floors of the Twin Towers at the time of attack. And there's proof in general, as he writes, that they were in the building and there during the time of attack. And now you need to prove it halachically. So his paradigm first is not quite the sugya of Mayim Shein Sof, but the similar sugya, which is there in Yevamot as well, which is the case of a person who falls into a furnace. Where we say that if someone falls into a furnace, we can testify that he died. And similarly, if he falls into a cauldron of boiling wine or oil, we can testify that he died. And he notes that the Ber Hetev's qualification of this is what? If it's the type of fire that he probably couldn't escape from. Right? Not a shallow fire. So that's his first conceptual move, is to basically view the fireball that the upper floors of the Twin Towers turned into, which in the North Tower was the 93rd floor and above, as a fire that people couldn't get out of. And again, you see that so much of this is about Metzius, where he has to say that this is what they know, that the stairwells, the elevators, it was too hot, they were consumed, and even the firefighters couldn't reach it and ended up being killed in the collapse. I mean, no one got in, no one got out of those floors. Now, the problem is he wants to distinguish it from what case? And this is a lot of what you get in Aguna Shaila. This is where you have to distinguish it from cases where people were machmir and say, this is different. So he has a case in the Nod Behuda, which sounds like you should be machmir. And that was the case of what? A man who went to the top of a roof during a great fire, and that was all you knew about him. And then you just had bones, and no one knew if they were the bones of the person. So some Talmidei Chachamim, the Chachamei Brod, had permitted the wife, and it said, Kanim Tzakan Haya. that if the husband had been there, so they're probably his. But the Nodes of Yehuda argued because there were people trying to save the people on top of the house, and therefore it could be someone else. So Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz argues that this can't be that case. Right? This is not like that case, and it's more similar to someone who falls into a fire because the Nodeb Yehuda was Machmir because there might have been people who came to save, except we know that no one accessed those floors to save them, and therefore there's no reason to assume that it's someone else's body. Right? That's his first conceptual move. He then moves to the Otzar HaPoskim, arguing that the fiery furnace case was expanded by many poskim to discuss similar cases, like a ship which caught fire while a man was tied up in chains, where the Rachash Gatinav argued that even though they didn't see that he died, that is the functional equivalent. We knew he was tied up in a boat that was consumed by fire, and his death was almost definitely immediate, so they equated it. And he said, so once you see that the poskim expand the category, we can conclude that there are cases that will view it as someone burning up, even though we didn't actually see him die. He says that the case of the person being tied up is similar to the North Tower, where from the 93rd floor and above, where the plane hit, we know that nobody could get out. So that's the first sniff, right? That's the first argument he makes in direction of Kula. His second is it might not only be fire, but it might be an avalanche. And the Gemara in Yevamot Kuf Yudalid, Nifsak and Shulchan Aruch, so he says there, a woman who says her husband died in an avalanche is not believed. So maybe you would think that would push you L'chumra, to say the woman can't get remarried. But Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz negates that argument, because he says, no, the problem there is that we're worried that the woman doesn't actually know what happened because she was running away from the avalanche. So she just assumes her husband got caught, but she couldn't have seen it directly. At least that's how Rashi takes it. That is a case of estimation, a case of assumptions. And therefore, Rav Cook argued that someone who died in war during the collapse of a mountain which fell on him or due an explosion, you would accept it because there isn't the fear that maybe the wife is just assuming it. In this case, there's a rov, which is better than Mayim Shein Lahem Sof. And therefore, building on Rav Kook, he says, in addition to the fire, anyone who didn't die in the fire died in the collapse of the building. So if you were in the part of the building where you couldn't get out, and you fell 93 stories, so this is a case in which you are buried under the rubble and couldn't have escaped, and therefore he thinks this is more like Rav Kook's avalanche, where, like the explosion in war, Rav Kook said you could assume that the husband was dead. And he said, especially here, where they didn't find any living person from that floor and above, for months, they only found crushed bodies. This sounds much more like Rav Kook's case, where he said you could argue that it is mutter to assume that the husband is dead. And he notes the Marash Engel in a similar case, where a husband was in a house where a grenade blew up the house entirely, where they found bones, and he said that he was willing to assume that it was the husband who died. Argument three is that the Kilat Yaakov, Eben Ezra, and the Imre Yosher argue that if you see someone fall from such a high building that the fall itself would kill him, you're allowed to let the wife remarry. So here, at least the people above the point of impact were in fire, in avalanche, because they were crushed by the debris, and at the very least, they fell those stories, because now you can add another sniff lahakel, because we know that they fell from those floors. He then adds that normally the problem of being matir a woman is that you're countering the chesket eshet ish, the knowledge that she was married. He said, here he thinks that this is all enough to override that, especially since we assume that these chumrot are derabanan, because fundamentally the chesket eshet ish is broken even when the woman falls into my she'en lem sof. So based on just those arguments, he was making, and this is what you see, right? it's not just the theory. Then you have to go through the painful detail of applying it to each case, each of which has its own specific. So he has the case of J.S., right, where he has an individual who worked on the 87th floor of the South Tower, where there were 14 people who worked in his office. 7 survived, 7 didn't. The 7 who survived didn't show up for work. The people who showed up for work all died. How do they know he was on that floor? So in that case, his wife called him. There was no answer. But one of another woman who was missing, who was on that in the office, called her mother and it said that she was present with this husband on that floor. So that already was enough for Gedaliah to say he was probably there. But then you add that. So remember we talked about Simanim? So they found what they think is part of his body. They found his wallet with ID cards, which, as we saw, is at least a Simon Bayman and maybe a Simon Mofak, which, according to many poskim, is enough. And therefore, we can add that to the fact that he was probably on that floor. And therefore, he says he can be Mekil, because A, it's like a fiery furnace. B, it's like being buried under an avalanche. And, as we saw, many poskim are willing to be Mekil and Simanim of things that you don't normally lend out, hence his wallet. The woman, therefore, can remarry, though she actually has to perform chalitza, because in that case, she died without children. So she had to do chalitza with the brother-in-law. I'll leave the Katlanit case on the side. Then, another thing that he adds to this is, as we said, one of the ways to make it is simanim. So in the case of what he calls the case of EL, so there they found dental records, which he argues, based on Movadia, is considered a simon muvhak, and therefore he's willing to be Mekel there. In the case of TB and his wife, so there, he actually talked to his wife and said that he was in the Northern Tower, though he had said that everything was going to be okay, but we knew from the phone call that he had stayed there in order to help save people. And in the South Tower, the crash was between the 78th and 84th floors, and he was on the 85th. And therefore, since we know he was there trying to save people, that is one of the reasons. And then, he takes as a given, like many modern poskim, that DNA is considered simon muvhak, and they found a piece of his thigh bone. And since the chance of messing up the DNA evidence is very low, so then he said you can combine that and bury the bone because you assume it's him. And here it's combination of the fiery furnace argument, the avalanche argument, the great height argument, plus the simon muvhak of the DNA. In this case, the woman was pregnant, so she did not have to do chalitza, which probably makes it worse, but that was the case. The next case is similar. The person was on the 104th floor. The next case of WG, as well, the reason you knew he was there is because he had phoned his wife and a friend had phoned him and said he was there. So he was willing to, so he was Mekel there. The more complicated case was the case of what he calls MG. Because there, they didn't know whether the husband had made it to work. So this made it much more complicated. So here, he hadn't phoned home. We didn't know for sure. We had no positive information that he went to work. So how do we know he's at the North Tower? This is a much harder case. So here, what he said was he's willing to combine the following snifim lahakel. One is the Dvar Yoshua had a case of a... in 1950, where a husband disappeared, had been seen in Tel Aviv going to the central bus station on his way to Ramat Yitzchak, and the bus was blown up by terrorists. Right, Ehrenberg quotes a Mabit who says that you're allowed to be mitzarif the argument that a person who leaves a certain place is headed home but doesn't arrive and no one's heard from him, you can say he's likely dead. And therefore was willing to say that this husband was known to have been going in that direction, probably on this bus. He was willing to say that case, we can assume based on his schedule, that he was probably in the dangerous place. So based on that, he's willing to say that since the husband should have been at work at that time, At least that will remove you from the from her being a chesgat eshet ish, being assumed to be married, because the rove will remove that, so at least move it to a derabbanan. Second svara is that there was peace amongst them, so we assume that the husband wasn't trying to escape home. And therefore, the fact that he didn't show up at home adds to the assumption that he probably is dead. The next line of argumentation he got from the Askel Avdi, where a brigade of Haganah soldiers went over a certain bridge that ended up being exploded. And in that case, again, the poskim allowed the wives to remarry because we know they went there, and there's no reason to assume they ran away. He added here the fact that we did have the evidence that he used his Metro card at the 42nd Street Port Authority between 8:12 and 8:17, which by that schedule would have gotten him to work by his normal time, which would have placed him on a floor where he would have definitely died. Combine that with the fact that the government was willing to assume that the person was dead, he said that means that, you know, that's not direct evidence, but that means that there's at least a basic assumption floating around that he's probably dead that we should at least take into consideration. That with that, he was willing to be mekel, but then they got better evidence and they got DNA, so combining all of that, he was willing to be mitzayif and be mekel. They had one case of a person who was on American Airlines Flight 11, where simply the fact that we had evidence that his ticket had been given in, which meant he was probably on the plane, that he felt was enough to say that it's the case of the fiery furnace which you can't escape. Then there was another case, DS, which was similar. He didn't put new arguments there. And then the last case of ML, again, the husband had actually called his wife. She pleaded with him to leave the building, but he said he wasn't going to. He was going to help people escape and help them. So we knew he was there because he was acting heroically. So the combination of knowing that he was there, plus we ended up finding DNA and fingerprints and some of his clothes, his driver's license, work permits were found. So combining the Siman Movak. Now, this person was on the bottom floor. He was on the bottom floor, so you didn't have the avalanche case. You didn't have the falling from a great height, but he said, because you have a DNA, you have a Siman Movak. The fingerprints is another Siman Movak. The personal possessions is another Siman Movak. And since he said that he wasn't leaving work, as he told his wife, it may not be falling from a great height, but it was an avalanche, right? Because he said he wasn't leaving, so you have good reason to believe that he was underneath the towers. And that was the sum of it. Now, what I think you just see is what it means, right, to be a dayan under these circumstances, to be combining, to realize that you're dealing with eshet ish in the end of the day, but you're also dealing with the rest of this woman's life. So you have to have the confidence to, on the one hand, muster as much of the halachic data as you can, combine as many kulot as you can, but then have the confidence to say it's mutter and live with that decision. Right? That is the mark of a great posek. And you have to be the type of person who has that knowledge and experience that you're willing to take that on your shoulders. You know, especially in Aguna, those are the type of poskim get involved. Now, as I said, one of the things that poskim will often do is, in order to bolster their decision, they'll get other poskim to agree, and that's really what you see throughout this book, where Willig signed on it, Rav Zalman Nechemiah Goldberg signed it, Ravadid signed it. They have other kulot that they were mitzarif as well. But I think this was just at least a window into what it means to be a important Rosh HaBezdin through the eyes of one of Rav Schwartz's really hardest cases, where you see the type of argument, and this is very different, I think you'll notice, than a lot of the other shirim, right? The way that a psak in an Aguna case works is very, very different. It's a lot of, right, combining arguments and combining mitzius and really getting into nitty-gritty, but that's what it means to be a posek on an Aguna case, especially a complicated one like this. And at least seeing the arguments that he made and the contribution he made to helping these women continue their lives after that tragedy should be le'ilui nishmato, because Klal Yisrael really did lose a very important posek and leader when he passed away. So I'm glad we could at least look at one of his tshuvot, understand a little bit of the complexity of the issues. L'zecher nishmato. Okay. We'll...